This is a Reconstructionist Radio production. To purchase this book, go to AmericanVision.org. The Problem of Slavery in Christian America, an Ethical Judicial History of American Slavery and Racism by Dr. Joel McDermott. Narrated by Joe Salant. Copyright 2017. Published by American Vision. Chapter 9, A Heritage of Lies. One historian has wryly stated, "Though we cannot approve, we can marvel at the labor which Southerners spent in demonstrating that God not merely tolerated, but sponsored slavery." Another adds, "The only philosophical justification of slavery that ever gained any real popularity among slaveholders was the religious one, and a high percentage of pro-slavery tracts were, in fact, written by clergymen." The reason for this popularity could be of two varieties. The defense of slavery made from the foundations of religion, scripture, etc., and those various other defenses reiterated with authority by trusted religious figures. The problem, however, arises in just how closely key religious leaders followed the religion they professed, both in their understanding and application of the scriptures, and in how candidly they expressed the facts and historical context to which they applied scriptural precepts. While hundreds of ministers published their countless defenses of slavery throughout the 19th century, one in particular bears the distinction of maintaining an entrenched defense of the institution of American chattel slavery, even after the results of the war erased that issue from the vocabulary of the vast majority of the rest of Southern apologists. That man, Presbyterian Robert Louis Dabney, fought racial integration in the church immediately after the war and would continue to fight for white supremacist and segregationist views in some of the starkest expressions of the time, certainly from clergymen until late into his life. When he died in 1898, he had published scores of articles, many of which fought against black rights and liberties, and he had advocated various forms of segregation and oppression. During his final decade, he oversaw the collection of his life's writings, which he published in collected form without amendment or apology. Dabney penned his A Defense of Virginia, and through her of the South, in recent impending contests against the sectional party during the war, but did not publish it until 1867. Through this and other works, including some we have already highlighted in previous chapters, Dabney exerted significant influence, particularly within his home denomination of Southern Presbyterians, and most particularly after the war. There were certainly writers who had far more influence as religious defenders of slavery. There were others whose works on the issue were more timely as apologetics against abolition or for the cause of secession, which were far more widely read in general. Dabney's importance lay in the fact, first, that he maintained the pre-war positions openly after the war without much attempt at all to disguise them under generalities such as the need to fight vagrancy or support constitutionalism, etc. Second, Dabney's fierce defense of virtually every aspect of Southern slavery long after the war helped lay the religious foundations and authority for the lost cause mythology that built the monuments and mindset of the racist South. Again, we could cite many others who shared Dabney's outlook and efforts at the time, and we will quote a few below. But as a figure who spoke candidly, clearly, forcefully, without hesitation and without regret, and yet utterly falsely while knowing better, we would probably be hard-pressed to find a better representative of how so many otherwise Bible-professing churches failed. on the issue of race relations. Third, Dabney is still a revered figure among many conservative Presbyterians as well as Southern apologists. And this leads to a peculiar opportunity for the spread of false facts and ideas about Southern culture, slavery, and racism still today. The majority of such people today would be quick to decry racism and white supremacy, as well as slavery. And when the name of a Dabney or others such as John Henley Thornwell the discussion, they show reverence with a mild grimace. But I don't agree with him on slavery. The problem usually is that most such people do not actually have an accurate view of Dabney or the other Southern Presbyterian theologians. They have not read the sources thoroughly themselves, and they have only been informed through secondary teachers, usually very partisan. They have been taught to see slavery as only a small blind spot in an otherwise admirable religious culture that ought to be redeemed and restored. God's people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, Hosea 4:6. And this is one area where ignorance over many decades has allowed tremendous damage to be done to our neighbors and ourselves. Fourth, the majority of conservatives and conservative Christians today share a blind spot view of slavery and racism, similar to that of the misinformed admirers of the Southern Presbyterians, providing little more in-depth review of Dabney than will act as a corrective to the much more general effects of misinformation and political polarization as well. The correction to all of these important aspects comes by knowledge. The main thrust of this book has been to address that problem head-on by conveying the unvarnished history of both the broader culture and the churches in such a way that the reader who has been misled through political polarization or some form of ecclesiastical, theological, regional, or other romanticizing of the history can see the fuller context, as difficult as it is to receive in many cases. Such romanticized views of different partisan groups usually come to sympathetic constituents under the expressed intent of correcting the revisionism of some rival political party or social group, yet curiously tend to produce even more erroneous revisionisms or distractions of their own. It is likely impossible to write a history fully free of one's own presuppositions, limitations, and constraints, but it is certainly possible to demonstrate the larger errors indulged in by those who had an obvious axe to grind, but never the courage to test their own roots by the axe of truth. To this end, the following chapter reviews some of the more astounding claims Dabney made about the South and her peculiar institution. Some of these will be easy to address by reference to history already written in previous chapters. In other cases, we have saved key discussions for this chapter and thus introduced new material or information in greater detail. As the reader will see, this is the proper place to consider some important claims about the practice of separating families and the vulnerability of female slaves. Likewise, we can see more clearly through other examples how important clergymen either openly sanctioned or refused to discipline some of the most objectionable elements of the system. Not only had the state's judicial system enshrined abuses, but the church adopted or covered for them too, thereby incurring the same ethical judicial guilt for themselves. When we consider the following claims in light of not only the history already given, but of the 5 points from George Keith highlighted in the last chapter, we must realize that the pro-slavery and racist defenses of men like Dabney do not only not come anywhere near proving their case, but as a barrage of half-truths and, as will be seen, conscience whitewashings. They stand as witness against themselves in the courtroom of Almighty God. There is no defense for the indefensible, But Dabney and a whole host of others tried to make one. They failed, but they deceived many. It is long past time that the multitudes deceived, or even remotely or secondarily influenced by them, have the outlook necessary to move forward with a new conviction and a new confidence in the service of God, and if necessary, to repent themselves. Southern defenders today routinely chant, "Heritage, not hate." But what is routinely called heritage is actually a mythology created for public consumption after the fact. It is a revisionism, and an easily disprovable one at that. It is impossible to build a Christian society on a heritage of lies, and perpetuating falsehoods is just another form of hate. The following review intends to help us abandon both. The defense of the indefensible. Don't blame the South for slavery. Near the opening of his defense, Dabney repeats a justification for Southern slavery heard many times from many of its apologists. The claim that the South never wanted slaves, but that powerful interests, including Northern traders, outside of their control, forced the institution upon them by delivering hundreds of slaves at Southern ports. Dabney made this claim in stark and absolute terms, saying Virginia was an unwilling recipient of African slaves. Her role was never that of an active party. Her government ever opposed the cruel traffic, and her citizens were precluded by Providence from the least participation in it. He further said that Virginia, from its very foundation as a colony, always denounced and endeavored to resist the trade, and was never stained by any complicity in the trade. Slavery had been fastened on her against her remonstrances by others. This argument was certainly not novel with Dabney. Southerners had made it from early on. Even Elbridge Gerry, the Virginia representative who openly condemned the slave trade in the first U.S. Congress, nevertheless excused his Southern countrymen in part on the grounds that they had been betrayed into the slave trade by the first settlers. But was it really true? If this had even the slightest kernel of truth to it, it could only have been true for Virginia and perhaps Maryland and Delaware. The next earliest Southern colony, South Carolina, was founded by Caribbean slaveholders specifically as a new slave colony venture. But as we saw in the first chapter, tremendous demand existed in Virginia as well. As early as 1620, when only a handful of blacks had been brought to Virginia, a review of growing labor demand and lust for social status among many lower and county-level officials and planters reveals that the sparsity of black slaves did not stem from a lack of interest in acquiring them. While well-connected officials and the wealthiest planters could dominate the buying throughout much of the late 17th and early 18th centuries, demand existed from private individuals and small planters too. During the tobacco boom of the late 1610s and 1620s, sustained English contact with Africa was only just beginning, and the possibility of obtaining slaves captured by privateers was blocked throughout most of the period for political reasons. The first large-scale increase in the British slave trade was almost entirely employed for sugar production in Barbados. Virtually all slavers sailed only to meet such known demand during this time. Getting anyone to risk the tremendous investment of shipping any substantial number of slaves with no guarantee of purchase would have been impossible. The fact that Chesapeake planters could even get a hand in this market shows that some Virginians were willing not only to pay the price required to obtain slaves, but also to make full use of their influence and connections to do so. There must, therefore, have been demand in early Virginia substantial enough to persuade investors to take the risk. Sure enough, closing in on mid-century. Members of the gentry began purchasing slaves as soon as they could get them and continued to buy more as fast as the limited supply and their individual resources would allow. Nothing prompted them to do so, other than the emergence of tobacco as a profitable, stable crop. Indeed, given the higher cost of slaves, the difficulties involved in getting them, and the elite's ability to dominate the servant market, the obvious explanation for the gentry's pursuit of slaves is that they simply preferred them. In the earliest days of the trade in Virginia, the Council of State dominated the purchasing and kept the trade as a virtual monopoly for themselves. Based on this, to begin with, Charles II's Company of Royal Adventurers in 1662 promised a constant supply of Negro servants to America and wrote that promise in the company's charter the next year. As we saw, however, Virginia made other attempts to stimulate supply, which reveals how much demand actually existed. In 1659, the council enacted a subsidy in the form of tax breaks for ships delivering slaves. The act allowed for a fat 80% off taxes for imports of tobacco to foreign nations if the ships of those foreign nations would first bring Negro slaves to Virginia ports. This was originally passed with an eye to tapping burgeoning supplies of slaves in Dutch West African factories. Although this plan only lasted a year, it again reveals enough of a demand for slaves in early Virginia that the state itself was willing to get involved in meeting it. Maryland did the same in 1671, but more candidly declaring that the measure was intended for encouraging the importation of Negroes and slaves into this province. By the 1660s and 70s, however, it was not only the most elite officers buying up the supply. 58% of county-level office holders owned slaves, and the number of slaves on their plantations had overtaken the number of white indentured servants. Even before Bacon's Rebellion, 1676, the majority of elites and lower gentry had already moved from white labor to black slavery. By 1675, they had already invested huge sums and already created a widespread market. With these conditions, the tremendous uptick in slave shipments that followed beginning in the next century was only logical. Still, demand continued. At least 10,348 slaves arrived in Maryland and Virginia from 1698 to 1709, a figure that probably excludes some substantial shiploads directly from Africa and certainly does not count numerous small groups of slaves brought from the West Indies. Yet even these did not at first satisfy the demand for labor. In what one scholar called frenzied buying, planters thronged the auction blocks and drove slaves to record prices. Blacks bought better prices than ever before, and for a time the Chesapeake surpassed Jamaica as the most profitable slave market in British America. In 1708, Acting Governor Edmund Jennings wrote to the Board of Trade complaining that the exuberance had ruined the credit of the country. The following year, Virginia's Lieutenant Governor Francis Nicholson reported to the Board of Trade regarding a sale of 230 blacks in York River. His comments relate the raging demand. "There were as many buyers as Negroes, and I think that if 2,000 were imported, there would be substantial buyers for them." In the end, while it was true that it was not Southerners who did the initial enslaving, and while it was not Southern ships that initially brought the slaves over, it was nevertheless the choice of the Southerners to buy the slaves and to embrace the slave system socially, legally, and politically. Virginians did not enslave the persons brought there by the Royal African Company or by the private traders. The only decision that Virginians had to make was to keep them as slaves. They could have made the decision to establish them as free members of society, but they did not. They made the decision to enslave them and to keep enslaving them and to keep importing more Africans as slaves, both as individual planters and as a culture. Furthermore, Virginia and the South generally not only kept importing and kept enslaving, they established a long series of laws which gradually defined Africans and their offspring as permanent chattel slaves. This was all driven and maintained by a combination of demand for slaves and racist fear of free blacks. The gradual and piecemeal adoption of the legislation that eventually served to define the property rights of masters in slaves suggests that each element of the definition responded to a perceived need of planters otherwise eager to purchase African workers. The very language of some of these acts states this directly. Were this not enough to establish the absurdity of claiming Virginia or the South was never stained by the complicity in the trade, we must remember a couple further key points. When Virginia was remonstrating against further importations of Africans, it was never out of a principled objection to the slave trade or to slavery. In the early days, they objected because they feared and loathed a growing black population. This is why, by at least 1809, the Virginia legislature decreed that all freed blacks must leave the state. They did not want more blacks because they were seen as a multiplying inferior race. About the time of the Constitutional Convention, Virginians added to this reason to stop the transatlantic trade. They had begun a profitable domestic trade, and slowing imports would drive up prices in her favor. At no point did Virginians in any substantial numbers express desire to end the trade or the institution of American slavery out of biblical principle. While this argument of Dabney's may seem somewhat trivial today, since it is so easy to refute from a historical perspective, it had much more force in its day for a couple of reasons. First, the North shared largely in the underlying premise of racism. One obvious answer to the whole charade would have been simply to allow these uninvited African immigrants to find jobs, move out to the frontier and start wilderness farms, go about their business, etc. But both North and South viewed blacks as an unwanted population, and most believed they could never be civilized or educated enough to live freely in harmony with whites. The "we never asked for them" argument invokes the unspoken argument, "you wouldn't want these Africans next door to you, would you?" To this, the vast majority of people, including Northerners, would have silently agreed, "no way." So then, what do you expect us to do with them? Just let them roam free by their tens of thousands? They'll starve, commit crimes, probably rape our women, and probably start a violent revolution against us. Through the premise of shared racism, genuine white supremacy, Dabney could prey upon the guilt and fear of his Northern opponents to justify the South's institution, while most Southerners who read this would have done so with a sense of satisfaction that their guy had trapped the Yankees in a corner. Either accept the blacks completely like friends yourself, or shut up about our solution for them. But do not blame us, because we only did what we had to do, and you would have done no differently. Sad as it is to have to say, this was the social reality of the day, and it was powerful, largely because the churches did not lead when they had the chance. Chattel and equal protection of the law? To refute the abolitionist argument that American slavery constituted chattel slavery, or ownership of the person outright, Dabney argues too much when he presents the case for the absurdity of criticizing African slavery in America. By this standard, he goes so far as to claim the slave codes, first, legislate for the slave as to his own conduct as a responsible human being, require of him intelligent obedience to perform the same moral rules which are enforced on his master. Third, they protect the person, being, and moral responsibility of the slave against his own master. If the master kills him, it is murder by the law. Dabney's remonstrance here is in part simply wrong and in part a classic subterfuge. Both aspects are tied together. To begin with, Dabney does not mention that some states openly constructed their laws as involving the ownership of the person specifically as chattel. As we saw in chapters 1 and 2, Virginia applied the chattel law of partus sequitur ventrum in order to confine black progeny to slavery forever. More explicitly, Southern Carolina's 1740 code revision called black slaves property of His Majesty and chattels personal. As if they had not been explicit enough, the state in 1754 reiterated that Negroes and other slaves are deemed to be chattels personal and are, in every respect, as much the property of their owners as any other goods or chattels are. Dabney had had to have had some awareness of these facts. We must not fault only the laws, however, for key clergy and social leaders expressed the same views in popular literature. Some of the most widely read defenses of slavery, Baptist minister Thornton Stringfellow's pamphlet, Scriptural and the Statistical Views in Favor of Slavery, 1856, reinforced the view of slaves as chattel and property repeatedly. Abraham's servants are inventoried as property which God has given. In Genesis, servants are property. In Exodus, the same institution which makes property of men and women is recognized. At Sinai, God speaks of servants as property. Joseph was a friend to absolute slavery. The law of God, according to Stringfellow, authorizes people to purchase men and women as property and even to breed slaves and sell them. Likewise, in one of the most widely read periodicals of the antebellum South, DuBose Review, an anonymous article entitled Slavery and the Bible, appeared with similar views in 1850. It states that the Bible, Genesis, for example, speaks of slaves always as property. No one can doubt, it says, that Abraham regarded his servants as property, that they were property bought and sold for money. God's law recognized property in man, including the right to trade in that property. Again, not only would Dabney very likely have been well aware of such publications, he would have known they represented the commonest of perceptions. He may have been technically correct to maintain the legal distinction he did, but it is absolutely inexcusable to blame abolitionists for what was the common understanding of slavery as the chattel ownership of the person. It was enshrined explicitly and prominently in some state laws, formed the foundation of others, and the most widely read publications of the day maintained it in the name of the highest authority, the Bible. Even without the explicit statements and common perception, the law practically bereaved the slaves of protection of their person and even life through various other means, loopholes that were in no way difficult for masters and slave drivers to know and exploit. Dabney says that if a master killed his slave, it is murder. But was it, really? Technically on paper, maybe. Remember, however, that proving murder requires the proof of malicious intent. Any master who beat a slave to death in vengeance or heat of passion was safe, as long as he had revealed nothing to a witness that could be used to prove malice, and no black could stand as a witness against him. Other loopholes in the law abounded. The Virginia Code, beginning in 1705, said that blacks who resisted correction could happen to be killed by such correction by accident without any punishment coming to a master. Runaway slaves could be killed on sight by any means necessary with legal impunity. South Carolina, by 1740, said any black found off their plantation who resisted a white could be lawfully killed without question. This immunity from prosecution was expanded from 1735 law, which required the black to have resisted with a weapon. Runaway slaves escaped below the Florida line could be killed for a reward. While a live capture could be worth more, the bounty hunter would need to only return with the scalp with the two ears for an immense reward, ranging from 20 to 50 pounds. Anyone injuring or killing a slave was technically presumed guilty, but the guilt was expunged in the court process merely by denying it under oath. He could simply say in any case that the slave had resisted and he feared for his life, or that he was punishing the slave and the slave attacked him, or that he approached a runaway who threatened him, whatever. There could be 1,000 scenarios made up, and each one would technically purge the complaint against him. His case then could only be rebutted upon the testimony of 2 white witnesses. Remember, blacks could not testify, and on a plantation where family members and white employees derived their livelihood from the master, who would risk speaking out against them unless they had clear proof, conviction, and willingness, if even then for a black slave, after all? Legal realities and double standards like these are the reason so few masters were ever prosecuted for killing slaves. The threat of death continually hung over the head of black slaves, despite the law, while the prosecution was rarely ever a threat at all to whites who killed slaves. While many critics and abolitionists had pointed out these realities amounted to virtually no check upon a master's brutality and punishment, Dabney called it an outrageous misrepresentation. But we can read all the laws and cases for ourselves. Dabney's own contemporary, Dr. James A. Lyon, admitted in 1863 that the laws of the land did not sufficiently protect the lives of the slaves. A wicked, drunken, or jealous overseer, or a low, malicious white man might take the life of a slave in the presence of 50 others, and yet if he was not seen by a white man, there was no legal evidence against him, and he could not be punished as his crime deserved. Dabney is without excuse here. Did the same rules really apply to the slave as to the master, as Dabney claimed? Again, as we have seen, legislation generally only allowed blacks to testify against other blacks. In such cases, they could do so in all causes whatsoever, but without oath. This one instance alone falsifies Dabney's claim. There are literally scores of instances of unequal treatment in the laws, and many of them could be the difference between life and death, or a severe beating, maiming, or other cruel punishments for a black slave. Interestingly, Dabney later refutes himself when he actually defends inequities in the laws as follows. The penal code of Virginia was properly made different in the case of the whites and the blacks. Because of the lower moral tone of the latter, many things which are severe penalties to the white man would be no punishment to the Negro. The slave was not permitted to testify against a white man, and this was a restriction made proper by his low grade of truthfulness, his difference of race, and the fact that he was to so great a degree subject to the will of another. Again, when citing the penalty for a white man convicted of rape, he unwittingly acknowledges that if the ravisher were a Negro, the penalty was different. How can anything close to this be considered the application of the same moral rules for both parties? Are penal sanctions not moral? Either way, Dabney confesses the injustice of the system he defends. At this point, the Southern apologist's only remaining pretense was the classic appeal to the paternalism of the masters. But seemingly, the severity of this restriction was almost wholly removed among us by the fact that he always had in his master an interested and zealous patron and guardian in all collisions with other white men. From oppression by his own master, he found his sufficient protection, usually in affection and self-interest. Except in the thousands of daily cases where they did not. Even George Whitefield, who later approved of and joined the practice of slavery, testified to the frequency of cruelties and the spilling of slave blood throughout the South. A couple of cases of equal treatment before the law occurred very early, before legislation cemented stark double standards throughout the legal codes. When a white man impregnated a black woman in Virginia in 1640, the Negress was whipped as a white woman would have been. The inequality here was by sex. The offending man was only required to do public penance during a church service in James City. But this was not always the case. In a 1630 case, the man was sentenced to a whipping as well for the mere sin of interracial fornication, which the court deemed as abusing himself to the dishonor of God and the shame of Christians by defiling his body in lying with a Negro, which fault he is to acknowledge next Sabbath day. Lastly, Dabney states that the law treats the slave so fully as a rational and responsible human that it even bestows on him the right of litigation against his own master in one case. Any African setting up a plea of unlawful detention and bondage against his master is allowed to sue in forma pauperis, as impoverished, the courts of law. First, why is it only in one case? Does this caveat not create at least some embarrassment for the author? Why does he not rather see this as an exception to the rule? In 99.99% of all other cases, the black is not treated fully as a rational and responsible human, if at all. Why is he forbidden to testify against a white or to serve on juries in every case there is, if the law indeed treated him as a fully rational and responsible human being? Yet even in the one case Dabney cites, the slave did not truly have any protection. In South Carolina, for example, the 1740 code did allow for slaves to sue for their freedom, but only if represented by a guardian. Well, who would this be? A freed black? No, a black could not testify against a white in court. So, what white person would step forward on behalf of a black slave? To ask the question is to answer it. Add to this that later laws throughout most of the southern states forbid any further manumissions of slaves unless the owner also provided financially to transport the freedman out of the state within a matter of days. The states did not necessarily find an increase in the enslaved black population, for this was revenue, but it did outlaw an increase in the free black population. Even in the rare case that a black could prove before the court that he or she was unlawfully enslaved and should be freed, he would then have to get out of the state in a certain number of days at their own expense, or in some states, face enslavement as a punishment. All incentive then, and eventually legal prohibition, worked against any blacks making such appeals before the poor courts. Most slaves were happy and content. Few abused? Dabney engages several times in an argument common among the defenders of the South, which we could call the fallacy of the happy slave. Dabney writes, Southern slaves received, on the average, better and more certain compensation than any laboring people of their capacity in the world. It came to them in the form of that maintenance which the master was bound by the laws, as well as his own interest, to bestow upon them. Elsewhere in his book, Dabney refers to slaves as happy, and this happy class, who were three times as prosperous, contented, happy, and moral as northern free blacks, and one and a half times as much so as the whites themselves. Even today, some Southern apologists allow themselves to be persuaded that a majority of the slaves were happy in their condition. Masters generally kind and paternal, and the system as a whole benevolent. One duo says that interviews with former slaves consistently portray an amazingly benign picture of Southern plantation life. Affection for former masters and mistresses is expressed in terms of unmistakable devotion. Many of the old slaves express a wistful desire to return to the plantation. Slave life was to them a life of plenty, of simple pleasures, of food, clothes, and good medical care. Are these accounts true? In short, the myth of the happy slaves was just that, a myth. The joyfully thankful slave existed virtually nowhere but in the self-congratulatory, idealistic mind of Southern paternalists themselves, or in the propaganda of those defending the system. Yes, some former slaves did claim such things later on, and we will discuss that later. Common sense alone, however, will suffice to provide enough evidence alone to answer the issue. Why, for example, were some of the severest penalties, along with some of the greatest immunities for whites, enacted for the case of runaway slaves in all slave states? Why must slaves be terrorized with graded punishments for first, second, third, and fourth offenses, up to castration and even death? Obviously, slaves desired to leave in general if the powers that be had to erect so many great and heavy barriers and threats to intimidate them from it. Add to this the demand for the Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution, and after the Underground Railroad became an effective tool to free slaves, the enhancement in 1850 of the Fugitive Slave Act. The widespread Southern connection that slaves were so well treated, clothed, and fed, had such filial affections for their loving paternal masters, and were generally as happy as anyone could be, flies in the face of the logic of the Fugitive Slave Act, indeed of all state fugitive slave laws, as well as the various laws designed to keep slaves under control and on the plantation. The two claims simply cannot be reconciled by any degree of reasonable measurement. Had the slaves been so well treated, cared for, and subjectively happy and contented with it, there would have been no need for slave laws, period. This consideration alone is enough to show how out of touch the claim is. Dabney goes so far as to deny even this reality. Such argument from abuses can only be just when it is shown that the wrongs pointed out are not incidental abuses, but legitimate and necessary and uniform consequences of the institution itself. But the incidental evils of American slavery among us are not such. It is abundantly proved by the simple fact that the thousands of masters held slaves among us and yet perpetuated none of these abuses. He added, "While we freely admit that there were in the South instances of criminal barbarity and corporal punishments, they were very infrequent and were sternly reprobated by public opinion. So far were Southern plantations from being lash resounding dens, the whipping of adult men and women had become the rare exception." He caps with the absolute. "Europeans and Yankees are always surprised at the leniency and tolerance of Southern masters." None of this, however, is true. Slaves in general were compelled by fear and threat of the lash and many other punishments to stay subjected to perpetual slavery. Slave life was characterized by routine physical punishment or the threat of it. This began very early and prominent men set the mold. William Burr II died 1744, the wealthy founder and planter of Richmond, Virginia, wrote about how he ruled his domain like one of the patriarchs, but sternly had to keep all my people to their duty and make everyone draw his equal share. Very much like the Jamaican monster Thomas Thistlewood covered earlier, Byrd's diaries are filled with entries of whippings and cruel punishments recorded with seemingly total indifference. In one case, a slave who urinated in his bed was whipped and upon a second offense was forced to drink a pint of piss. Byrd was as conscious of his methods as he was indifferent, and he considered his founding example as a rule of thumb. The unhappy effect of owning many Negroes is the necessity of being severe. Numbers will make them insolent, and then foul means must do what fair will not. Attempts to quantify lashings suffer from a lack of systematic data. Only a few planters kept regular diaries, including all of their whippings. From the few we have, it appears most slaves received whippings during their lifetimes, but these incidents could vary from once or twice in a lifetime to regular brutalities. One reviewer points out that beatings themselves, damaging as many of them were less important than the ever-present threat of such punishment. Only a single instance on a single slave could suffice to press a whole plantation into begrudging or cowering submission. Yet the same reviewer calculates that for one of the few systematic examples we have, a slave was whipped on average every 4.56 days, or three slaves roughly every 2 weeks. While the slave ship or chains or manacles may have been more common symbols today, the whip was probably the single most pervasive symbol of slavery in American life. Had the lash been so infrequent as Dabney suggests, general stores would not have contained regular stocks, as common as kitchen utensils, of such an instrument designed specifically for the purpose. One of the more popular narratives, written by former slave William Wells Brown, stated how every black had heard the crack of the whip and the screams of the slave. It came very frequently and freely, and a small offense on the part of a slave furnished an occasion for its use. If the slave codes detailed in the earlier chapters did not contain enough evidence of the pervasive threat of the whip, keep in mind that it did not need even a sanction from an encoded law. It was the standard punishment for a displeased master in all instances where there was no written law. Slaves could suffer the lash for visiting their mates, learning to read, arguing or fighting with whites, working too slowly, stealing, fighting, or quarreling with other slaves, drunkenness, or for trying to prevent the sale of their relatives, for impudence, asking their masters to sell them, claiming they were free men, breaking household articles, or for giving sexual favors to persons other than their masters. This just barely scratches the surface. Some were whipped for praying in private. Others had been seen chained so that they could not attend church on Sunday. The difference between a nice master and mean one would not be so much not whipping versus occasional cruel whipping, but more like occasional whipping of a few stripes compared to regular whippings of 75 lashes. And this is not even considering yet the actual cruel masters. Outside of the mainstream, which included both good and bad lashings, there were extremes. A few slave owners refused out of principle ever to use physical punishments at all, and some slaves recalled benevolent masters. This extreme does not seem as important, however, as the other. Characteristically, stocks closed on hapless women and children. Mothers cried for the infants torn cruelly from their arms. And whimpering black women fought vainly to preserve their virtue in the face of the lash, or pleaded for mercy while blood flowed from their bare buttocks. See the section on sexual abuse below. A cacophony of horrendous sounds constantly reverberated throughout such plantations. Nauseated black men vomited while strung up over slowly burning tobacco leaves. Vicious dogs tore black flesh. Black men moaned as they were hung up by the thumbs, with the whip raising deep welts into their backs. And they were bent over barrels or tied down to stakes, while paddles with holes in them broke blisters on their rumps. Frequently, blacks called God's name in vain as they fainted from their master's 100th stroke or had their brains blown out. The slaves described masters of this stripe as besotted, vicious, deceitful, coarse, licentious, bloodthirsty, heartless, and hypocritical Christians who were pitiless fiends. The scholar who compiled this list admitted it would have sounded too harsh were it not substantiated by a great deal of evidence in antebellum court records, newspapers, memoirs, and plantation diaries. He continues, "Quite frequently, even the most cultured of planters were so inured to brutality that they thought little about the punishment meted out to slaves. Floggings of 50 to 75 lashes were not uncommon. On numerous occasions, planters branded, stabbed, tarred and feathered, burned, shackled, tortured, maimed, crippled, mutilated, and castrated their slaves. Thousands of slaves were flogged so severely that they were permanently scarred. In one outstanding case, a Mississippi planter must have exhausted himself or held shifts where he placed a full 1,000 lashes on an unfortunate slave's back. Make no mistake, either the reference to court records rarely means such men were brought into court to account for justice to the slave, but rather that owners were usually suing overseers or others for damages to their investment. There is no end to the catalog of atrocities. Whips were used regularly, but so were sticks, pistols, knives, fists, feet, shovels, and tongs, or virtually any suitable object within reach. In one case, a mistress beat her female slave to death with a broomstick. In another, a female slave died from tetanus after having her hands nailed to a barrel. The former famous slave, Charles Ball, wrote in his narrative of a young mother slave who arrived late to the field. The overseer forced her to lift her dress, then proceeded to strike 10 lashes on her naked hips with a long whip, every touch of which brought blood and a shriek from the sufferer. A Boston paper in 1718 ran a story of a man who allegedly caught a black man raping a white woman and punished the rapist in the act by sneaking up behind him unawares to cut off his unruly parts. The act, probably apocryphal, demonstrated a socially acceptable cure for this particular malady. In 1762, a black slave in North Carolina was punished for the same alleged crime by having his private parts cut off and thrown in his face during his execution. In a yet more gruesome case, in 1856, an overseer punished a runaway by nailing his penis to a bedpost with a shoemaker's tack, then whipping him until, in his contortions from the pain, he literally wrested himself free of the nail. The slave died from his injuries. The absentee owners then sued the overseer, not for murder, but for damages and the loss of the slave. The overseer countersued, unbelievably, for damages to his reputation. The court basically called it a tie by awarding the owner only a small percentage in comparison to what he had asked. The broader reality was revealed, especially after emancipation. Among many examples at the time, Presbyterian author G.J. A. Colson repeated the happy slave myth when he blamed the combination of the Freedmen's Bureau and carpetbaggers for turning the slaves back to savagery after the war. Nothing else under the wide heavens did so much to transform the happiest peasantry on the face of the earth into a race of idle, discontented, and vicious vagrants. In this contest, others expressed their desire to return to the discipline of the whip. One master recorded how he thought his overseer must long for the old strap now that it was illegal. As for myself, I would give a good deal to amuse myself with it a little while. I've come to the conclusion that the great secret of our success was the great motive power contained in that little instrument. Another echoed what was a common sentiment. They can't be governed without the whip. He also shows the planters were aware of the power that just an occasional whipping had. Now, on my plantation, there wasn't much whipping, say once a fortnight, but the Negroes knew they would be whipped if they didn't behave themselves, and the fear of the lash kept them in good order. The question of the frequency of abuses and punishments finds further illustration when we consider Dabney's claim. Europeans and Yankees are always surprised at the leniency and tolerance of Southern masters. Not only have we read from many such individuals, Frederick Law Olmsted, Francis Kemble, Alexis de Tocqueville, to name a few, who spoke clearly otherwise, there was one outstanding figure who incidentally answers Dabney in a very unique and direct way. In 1842, Charles Dickens toured the U.S. and took notes. When he returned home, he published a book called American Notes, which contains a chapter on slavery. While far too long to reproduce in its entirety here, Dickens's report included a long list of American newspaper ads for runaways and slave sales. A sampling is illustrative. The following are a few specimens of the advertisements in the public papers. It is only 4 years since the oldest among them appeared, and others of the same nature continue to be published every day in shoals. Ran away. Negress Caroline had a collar with one prong turned down. Ran away. A black woman, Betsy, had an iron bar on her right leg. Ran away. The Negro Manual, much marked with irons. Ran away. A Negro boy about 12 years old had round his neck a chain dog collar with De Lampert engraved on it. Ran away. A Negro woman with two children. A few days before she went off, I burnt her with a hot iron on the left side of her face. I tried to make the letter M. Ran away. The mulatto wretch Mary had cut on the left arm, a scar on the left shoulder, and two upper teeth missing. Dickens interrupts a list of about 50 such ads to share. I should say, perhaps, in explanation of this latter piece of description, that among the other blessings which public opinion secures to the Negroes is the common practice of violently punching out their teeth, to make them wear iron collars by day and by night, to worry them with dogs, are practices almost too ordinary to deserve mention. He then continues, "Ran away. My man Fountain has holes in his ears, a scar on the right side of his forehead, has been shot in the hind parts of his legs, and is marked on the back with a whip. $250 reward for my Negro man, Jim. He is much marked with shot on his right thigh. His shot entered on the outside halfway between the hip and knee joints. Taken up, a Negro man is very much scarred about the face and body and the left ear bit off. Ran away, my mulatto woman, Judy. She has her right arm broke. $25 reward for my man John. The tip of his nose is bit off." Dabney suggests that such treatments were only incidental, very infrequent, and were sternly reprobated by public opinion. Dickens's sampling alone shows how very infrequent such things as iron collars, shackles, cropped ears, scars, dog attack injuries, and even gunshot wounds, in fact, were. They were so identifying to individual slaves that owners regularly used them instead of any last name. So sternly did public opinion reprobate such cruelties that scores of masters could regularly advertise them in the papers. Literally thousands more showed up in notices for slave auctions, sheriff sales, and other public notices. Not only did public opinion not prevent abuses, but the whole slave system and all of its attendant evils was public opinion. Dickens nailed the appeal to public opinion, too. They lift up their voices and proclaim public opinion is all sufficient to prevent such cruelty as you denounce. Public opinion? Why public opinion in the slave states is slavery, is it not? Public opinion in the slave states has delivered the slaves over to the gentle mercies of their masters. Public opinion has made the laws and denied the slaves legislative protection. Public opinion has knotted the lash, heated the branding iron, loaded the rifle, and shielded the murderer. Public opinion threatens the abolitionist with death if he ventures to the South and drags him with a rope about the middle in broad, unblushing noon throughout the first city in the East. Public opinion has, within a few years, burned a slave alive at a slow fire in the city of St. Louis, and public opinion has, to this day, maintained upon the bench that estimable judge who charged the jury, impaneled there, to try his murderers, that their most horrid deed was an act of public opinion, and being so, must not be punished by the laws the public sentiment had made. Public opinion hailed this doctrine with a howl of wild applause and set the prisoners free to walk the city, men of mark and influence and station, as they had been before. He continues for another 2,400 words in this vein, declaring the tender mercies and blessings public opinion had bestowed upon blacks. Dabney may have never read Dickens' comments. In fact, it is hard to imagine he would have penned his appeal to public opinion if he had. Then again, the larger realities exposing the fallacy of the benevolent South and the happy slaves could not have eluded him either. And he still claimed it. Perhaps most importantly, however, while even a good number of masters may have spared the lash and provided many kindnesses to the slave, as scholars have long recognized, the fact that a system existed in which widespread abuses, let alone regular whippings in general, were not only possible but recorded in well-known facts stands as a condemnation enough of that system. Truthfully, in fact, can even the gentler disciplinarians in such a system be called good if they stood by and did nothing at all to stop or prosecute the widespread bad elements in it? Far from incidental abuses, the whole spectrum of cruelties from regular whippings to maniacal and sadistic torture and killings was indeed legitimate and necessary and uniform consequences of the institution itself. Because the institution allowed evil masters to get away with wicked cruelties through loopholes, censored witnesses, and blind eyes, Dabney's own words, making his claim betray the reality he seeks to deny. When your argument concludes, the whipping of adult men and women had become the rare exception, emphasis added, even if that were true, and it was not, you have witnessed against yourself at some time prior it was not the exception. But what about those alleged interviews with former slaves themselves? When thoroughly read and properly understood, they reveal a much different picture than Southern apologists have claimed. For some of this further perspective, see the section on sexual abuse below. For greater detail, see the appendix, A Historian's Look at the Ex-Slave Interviews. Marriages and families, not often separated? One of the most censurable atrocities of American slavery was that it forcibly ruptured the families of the enslaved, spouses from each other, parents from children, and more. Were this the only charge against the institution at all, it should have been enough for Christians to unite against it. The charge was widely maintained and recognized, in some cases acknowledged as a flaw by religious authorities. Yet defenders of slavery worked diligently to deny it or minimize it. Dabney was one of these. Another charge against us is that our laws abrogated the rights of marriage among slaves, authorized their capricious separation by masters, and thus consigned them to promiscuous concubinage like that of beasts. He answered the charge. But is it asked, did not the master possess the power to separate this union at his will? And was not this power often exercised? They did. The power, relatively, was not often exercised. But the power of separating was sometimes abused by masters, and the room for this abuse was just the defect in our laws. We conclude this section with a few words touching the admitted abuses of the system, says Dabney, that existed among us, both legislative and individual, is fully admitted. There were cruel masters. Slaves were sometimes refused that which the apostle enjoined masters to give them as just and equal. Some cruel punishments were inflicted. A few slaves have been tortured to death. Some wives and children were wickedly torn from their husbands and parents. And our laws in some points failed to secure to the slaves that which their humanity entitled them. But we repeat, these things prove only the sinfulness of the individual agent and not of the system of which they were incidents. There was no sense trying to deny the infraction. Everyone knew it occurred. The law did not recognize slaves as persons, and thus did not recognize marriages between slaves as legally protected. Slaves did, in fact, marry regularly, just as everyone else, but they had no legal protection or support for their marriages. Churches recognized them as having moral force, especially after a couple decades of abolitionist pressure, and when war loomed like divine judgment. But in practice, masters could break marriages and families apart at will with no legal sanction and without any ecclesiastical sanction apart from perhaps admonishment. This problem has been noted in one of the earliest written attacks on slavery, Samuel Sewall's The Selling of Joseph, 1700. Likewise, legislators in Pennsylvania recognized as early as 1780 that the institution in general tore families apart. In the preamble to its emancipation law of that year, they acknowledged the unnatural separation and sale of the husband and wife from each other and from their children, an injury the greatness of which can only be conceived by supposing that we were in the same unhappy case. Abolitionists hammered the South for engaging in the practice and shamed the churches, not only for tolerating it in society, not only for refusing to discipline their slaveholding members who engaged in it, but for virtually ignoring the problem altogether over the decades. Only late did the churches give serious attention to this greatest of crimes committed under the system. In 1859, the Southern Episcopal Church finally got around to addressing the issue. A committee supplied its convention of that year with an ingenious piece of evasion in the guise of church government. First, it said that slaves suffering from forcible separations were not at fault if they remarried. They could not help it, and it was now as if the old marriage was dead. They should be allowed to do so. Second, it said masters were culpable before God for separating them. Third, it said the state allows it. Beyond this, the committee suggested nothing. It said nothing about urging states to change the laws. Worse, even though it condemned such a master's actions in the strongest possible terms as breaking God's law and disregarding his commands, it suggested no church discipline at all and no censure beyond informing the master he must stand before God the final judge. In 1863, Dr. James A. Lyon told the Presbyterian General Assembly they should start making some changes and get their institution up to the biblical standard. This included, among other things, getting the law of the land to recognize slave marriages. The address, little too late as it was, sparked some acknowledgement. A correspondent to the North Carolina Presbyterian under the name Osman responded, "There is scarcely an intelligent Christian in the Confederate States who does not believe that the institution of slavery is divinely recognized and sanctioned. There is, at the same time, scarcely one among us, certainly not one enlightened Christian, who does not admit and deplore the existence of certain legalized abuses of the system as it obtains in the Southern states. We refer to the enactments which forbid teaching the slave to read and to the absence of laws establishing the marriage relation. By positive enactment and by culpable dereliction, we have, as a people, sinned against our common humanity and, what is worse, against the Lord." Dr. Lyons' views hardly won everyone, though. An anonymous article in the Southern Presbyterian Review rejected Lyons' suggestion because legal protections for slave marriages would give the law a foothold of jurisdiction in the master's near-total domination over his slaves, and that would endanger the whole slave system. It would snap at once the tie that binds the slave to the family and place him as the subject of civil legislation under the dominion of the state. From that unlucky moment, we may date the decay of domestic slavery until the whole fabric would totter to its base or fall like the sudden downcome of a tower with vast and hideous ruin. He continued, "The master is armed with the unlimited power in law to separate husband and wife, parent and child, and under some undefined notion that this is wrong, without much calculation of actual results or carrying our investigation below the surface of appearances, we hasten to conclude that to exercise this power wantonly, in spite of the tears and heart agonies of helpless human beings, must become a debased appetite that grows by what it feeds on, the history and existing facts, as well as the true philosophy of domestic servitude, contradict this senseless theory." His position was utter defiance. Yes, masters have this unlimited power. Yes, some exercise this power wantonly. Yes, spouses and children cry. Does that mean we're bad people? Does that mean that the practice is widespread? We could hear him agreeing with Dabney's claim. It happens not often. Yes, masters can exercise this power whenever they want. But do they really? Not only did many people, including the churches, know the answer at the time, it has now become quantifiable and well documented by modern scholars. The basic fact is that the domestic slave trade carried hundreds of thousands of slaves, mostly children and slaves of marriageable age, and virtually no child was traded with its father, nor wife sold with her husband. One study that sparked much of the very searching critical review on the subject originally concluded relatively low percentages of marriage separations. Subsequent research uncovered several flaws in the research, not the least of which was that it had focused only upon the domestic trade to New Orleans, which was highly specialized for the sugar industry and not representative of the South as a whole. Likewise, it did not probe beyond the assumption that all slaves sold as individuals from trading companies were in fact single, not married before having been bought by the trading company or broken up by the company before sale, etc. Nevertheless, even with these flaws, the study concluded that up to 13% of interregional sales broke marriages apart. But the full data was yet to come in. When scholars corrected the flaws and assumptions, a different picture arose and has emerged as a consensus. One scholar focused upon slave records compiled in Mississippi immediately after the war. It concluded that for all registrants, 17% had been forcibly separated from a spouse. When limited to the older lot, those 50 or older, in 1865, who would have had more experience of the height of the domestic trade, the percentage rose to 23%. A far more exhaustive study than this had concluded similarly. The most definitive work yet to date, based upon the bills of sale, marriage certificates, slave narratives, slave traders' lists, letters, circulars, accounts, and more, concludes that trading activity during the domestic trade and migrations forcibly separated between 25 and 33% of all first marriages of slaves. It is typical to hear the round figure of 1 million slaves moved during the domestic expansion and trade. But even if we limit ourselves to a more conservative figure of 875,000 mentioned earlier, 25% amounts to 218,750 marriages ripped apart forever. The more probable rate of 33% would indicate 288,750 violated marriages, even if we were to return to the superseded flawed figure of 13%, it would still represent a startling 113,750 forcible separations. As astounding as these figures may be, they account only narrowly for marriages, not family separations altogether. The same study also accounts for ages, children, and other factors to conclude that just over 50% of those traded would have experienced broader family separations of some degree, spouses, parents, siblings, and other relatives. Taking this 50% of 875,000, we arrive at 437,500 people forcibly separated from families altogether. Not even the lowest of any of these figures could by any stretch of the imagination be honestly described as not often. One out of four, one out of three, or even one out of ten. These were not infrequencies, especially when the raw numbers were in the hundreds of thousands. Dabney had to have known better. He lived in Richmond, Virginia, from 1853 until the end of the war. Richmond was one of the key centers of the domestic slave trade during the time. It was growing at an astounding rate in the last decade before the war. Accounting records show that by 1860, the city contained 50 businesses dedicated to the domestic trade, including 18 different trading companies and several different supporting agencies that sold life insurance on their investments. Dabney had to have walked downtown like any normal person. He had to have witnessed the slave traders' pens and markets firsthand, probably many times. There is no excuse for denial, dismissal, or minimizing of the sin. Not a single case of a white man raping a black woman? The legal vulnerability of black women, mentioned in Chapter 1, remained throughout the slave era, legally and into Reconstruction and beyond practically as well. In one of the most tragic realities of American slavery, the law and culture left female slaves vulnerable to sexual assault in a variety of ways. Rumors, claims, and accusations abounded of white masters, sons, and overseers who would have their way with female slaves. Dabney, however, utterly denied that such rapes ever occurred in the entire history of his state, and he brought in Becca for his claim. We have caused a thorough search to be made by the most competent authority in Richmond, and while many indictments are found against black men for rape of white women, none exist in the history of our jurisprudence against white men for rape of black women. And this not because there would have been any difficulty in making the indictment lie, but because, as the most experienced lawyers testify, the crime is unheard of on the part of white men amongst us. While it is admittedly difficult to get a full objective account of the facts regarding the sexual exploitation of the vulnerable during this era, It is plenty more than enough to expose Dabney's astounding claim. We know the legal structure allowed white rape of black slaves. Beyond the few fig leaves of legal protection, women in general had little recourse against a conniving man, and black women had virtually none. It should not surprise anyone that virtually no court cases exist in which a white man was charged with raping a black female. In fact, one of the definitive collections of judicial cases concerning slavery in the American South, in five thick volumes, indeed reveals not a single case of such rape. This means that a Southern apologist could use such a statistic to deny racism and boast of the broad prevalence of Christian morality in the South. Those lying abolitionists keep saying we rape our slaves, but look, there is not a single case of such in all of our court records. Case closed. But it is easy to make such a claim about one's courts when such an act was not against the law to begin with. There are also no court cases charging white men with taking a walk in the park because it was perfectly legal. Yes, raping a black woman when practiced with minimal circumspection was just as legal as taking a walk in the park, even if it had not been. Since a black could not testify against a white in court, they could never have brought such a charge to begin with. Further, even after Reconstruction, when raping a black was criminalized and blacks could testify against whites in court, there was no guarantee that a judge or jury would respect the testimony or the charge. Indeed, there are recorded cases of judges rejecting the claims of black women because they were black and nothing else. In this light, the silence of the court records is hardly a celebration of the South's morality or refutation of the charge, but a condemnation of its legal system. Add to this the degraded view of blacks most whites propagated about them. Black women were considered naturally promiscuous and seeking sexual encounters with white men, especially masters, because it could lead to favors, decreased work, etc. Blacks were considered sexually aggressive in general, and the myth pervaded that black men were especially obsessed with raping white women. Yet in South Carolina, for example, between 1785 and 1865, only a total of 58 slaves were executed for rape, which amounts to only 0.725 executions per year. Raping a white female could mean death, while raping black females was virtually unpunishable at law. Though widely repeated, some anti-slavery activists, even at the time, rejected the belief in black hypersexuality and condemned the notion that black men naturally desired to rape white women, or that black women were naturally Jezebels infatuated with having sex with white men. Even some who were themselves racist and abhorred the thought of racial amalgamation thought the stereotype ridiculous. North Carolinian Quaker Benjamin Sherwood acknowledged the sexual lust of the implicated whites as well, noting the eager role of plantation owners' sons, as well as the far more scandalous notion that the wives and daughters of slaveholders are oftener the mothers of mulattoes than are the poor women, for which he supplied anecdotes and names. Fellow activist Thomas Hunt suggested that if even race mixing were a problem, emancipation would solve it, for the female slave would be further removed from the power of her master. If a white man raped the slave of another man, the most that could be charged would be a civil suit for the damages to the owner's property. Thomas R. R. Cobb of Georgia was one of the most prominent legal scholars in the South. He stated, "The violation of the female slave carries with it no other punishment than the damages which the master may recover for the trespass upon his property." When he published his definitive treatise, The Law of Negro Slavery, He thought lawmakers should look into the possibility of making the rape of a female slave indictable. It was 1858, after all. It had been long enough. Nevertheless, he seems motivated more by abolitionist pressure than anything. It was hardly for the women themselves, but for the honor of the statute book. Cobb also demonstrated a general cruelty regarding the black family. When one of his female slaves misbehaved, Cobb sold off her four youngest children as a form of punishment. White masters, sons of masters, or taskmasters could therefore approach black women for sex, assuming the socially acceptable fiction that the women naturally wanted it, with a broad array of coercions at their service and assurance that, even in cases of overt rape, chances were very small that they could or would ever be prosecuted. With only a modicum of cover, any white man could have overcome the remaining obstacles of social and religious stigma. The reality of divorce remained, but it was greatly weakened by other social impediments to an offended wife. Indeed, there are even accounts of men who flaunted their black mistresses right in front of their wives, and even slept with them in the same rooms, some casually and some in taunt. What historical evidence do we have, then, of white men raping black slaves? We have slave narratives, documents collected by the Freedmen's Bureaus during Reconstruction, a large batch of interviews of aged former slaves, over 2,300 firsthand accounts, compiled by the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s, and countless sporadic records. All of these are of greater or lesser value depending on their veracity. When controlled for key personal and sensitive factors, these sources can give a general idea of the conditions that slaves endured. The sole attempt the author has seen in various sources at providing some objective determination of the prevalence of the sexual assaults black slave women suffered reveals that when black females were interviewed by other black females, the situation in which we would expect the least inhibition and thus the greatest candor on the issue, former slaves reported forced sex in 18% of cases. From this, we might conclude that forced sex was a problem on roughly 1 out of 5 plantations. Given what we now know from other scholars about the general reliability of these ex-slave interviews and the reasons why they generally underrepresent abuses and cruelties, even though they contain innumerable instances as they are, we can rightly suspect that the 1 in 5 number itself, as bad as it is probably too low. Instances of sexual abuse are not difficult to find, and they come in various forms. As we saw with Thomas Jefferson earlier, owners valued female slaves in some cases, particularly for the profitable side of their reproductive capacity. Masters could even brag of their altruism in other areas, such as keeping slave families together, not working them too hard, and sparing the whip while they simultaneously violated their persons in this regard. In one such case, related from the Texas slave interviews, elderly former slave Rose Williams recalled how her master forced her to mate with another slave under such conditions. "I allus hold it against him. What he done him forced me to live with that nigger Rufus against my wants." She went on at length to tell how she physically resisted Rufus because he was big and a bully, and even landing a fire poker on his head. But when she complained, the owner's wife told her that because she and Rufus were both stocky, "The master wants you twins to bring forth portly children. These would, of course, bring a premium on the slave market." When Rose continued to resist, her master came to her directly, as she related, "A woman, I's pay big money for you, and I's done that for thee because I wants you to raise me chillens. I's put you to live with Rufus for that purpose. Now, if you doesn't want a whipping at the stake, It used to do what I wants. When Rose considered her master had saved her from her family being separated when he bought her and how relatively lenient he had been so far, the threat of one whipping was all it took to yield to this affront. Former slave William J. Anderson wrote in 1857, I have known him to make four men leave their wives for nothing and would not let them come and see them any more on the peril of being shot down like dogs. He then made the women marry other men against their will. Oh, see what it is to be a slave, a man, like the brute is driven, whipped, sold, comes and goes at his master's bidding. The war itself, in some cases, exacerbated exploitation rather than remedied it. Gangs of whites were reported to break into some slave homes and commit rapes on married slaves. In some cases, white Southern police forces engaged in systematic rapes. In Mobile, they arrested select black women and gave them the choice of submitting to sex or prison, where more guards would menace them as well. African Methodist Episcopal minister Henry Turner highlighted what had apparently become a well-known phenomenon in an Emancipation Day speech in 1866. Are there any differences in our women? White men can answer this question better than us. The ultimate insult, perhaps, came from their purported liberators. Multiple accounts document Union soldiers raping or attempting to rape white women during and immediately after the war, and not only in a few locations. In one case, plantation diarists in Georgia record how their slaves resisted the assaults of Sherman's troops three times in 2 weeks. Others, however, did not escape victimization. Union soldiers raped slave women in numerous cases, sometimes in the presence of their families, children, fathers, grandfathers, grandchildren. In one case, when black men attempted to defend their women from rape en masse, Union soldiers beat them and threatened to kill them. The company commander, obviously having lost control, offered the telling admission, the morals of the old plantation seem revived in the army of occupation. By far, however, Southern slave owners outrivaled the war-ridden savages of any army or occupation in the sexual exploitation of the blacks. The available sources are filled with testimonies of former slaves recalling abuses and rapes, and of the aftermath of living their freed lives under glaring eyes that viewed them as dependent sexual objects, and in some reports, raped them at will. In at least one Louisiana case in 1865, the complaints of three former slave women landed two perpetrators in jail. For their sexual assaults while drunk, the two men received the relatively lenient penalty of $15 fines, roughly $300 today, due to previous good character. One slave recalled the licentiousness of his Tennessee master, several of whose slaves had chillin' by him. Then one resisted him. He beat her with a paddle with holes in it. Another slave named John Finley witnessed the worst whipping he ever saw after a slave named Sharanda hit her master with a hoe to ward off his sexual assault against her. In the early stages of Reconstruction, a Georgia court allowed a slave woman to testify in a divorce case, despite the owner's, the defendant's, objections. The wife sued for divorce, alleging adultery, and her maid revealed to the court how he had made repeated attempts at her body, from offering her money to forcing his way through her window and throwing her onto her own bed, though he was never able to complete the act. In another case, a master simply forced his slave girl at gunpoint. Repeated rape, forced prostitution, and gang rapes are not unheard of either. a former Georgia slave, told how her sister, just a small girl, was regularly raped. They'd make her go out and lay on a table, and two or three white men would have sex with her before they'd let her up. The girl ended up dying in her childhood. Another referred to how she was conceived because boys on her plantation, assuming the white boys, sons or relative of the master, tied up her mother one day and took turns on her for the whole afternoon. One former Tennessee slave summarized the common reality during the slave era. "I know plenty of women slaves who went along with the old master. They had to do it or get a killing." Another recalled how masters usually remained covertly with one girl steady to avoid the detection that could lead to social stigma, but ultimately noted they had few boundaries. They would go wherever they could get it. In a widely cited interview, Mrs. Minnie Folks of Virginia recounted how her mother endured horrific abuse when she rejected the sexual advances of an overseer. "You know, there was an overseer who used to tie mother up in the barn with a rope around her arms and over her head while she stood on a block. Soon as they got her tied, this block was moved and her feet dangled. You know, couldn't reach the floor. This old man now would start beating her naked until blood run down to the back of her heels. I took answer, the whelps answered for my own self, with these here two eyes. Well, honey, this man would bathe her in salt and water. Don't you know them places was a hurtin'?" Such masters and overseers did not spare pregnant or nursing mothers. In what is reported to be a practice used widely, the thoughtful discipliner would dig a depression to accommodate the mother's pregnant belly as she was forced to lie down for a whipping. Then he would whip her so that the blood and milk flew mingled from their breasts. While the description may cross into hyperbole, any practice that provided simultaneously for the protection of the fetus and the abuse of the mother reveals a mentality twisted enough to deserve it. The mental partition between nurture and torture with the same mind and by the same hand manifests should be studied as forms not of just cruelty, but of psychopathy. There is probably no end to the mental anguish endured by the faithful wives of such planters. Just for starters, they frequently spoke privately of the fear of contracting venereal diseases due to their husbands' visits to the slave quarters. According to one contemporary account, the problem already affected the young man, and the University of North Carolina was never free from the clap, which was blamed on female slaves. But whether out of fears, jealousy, retribution, general pent-up rage, mental illness induced by the circumstances, or even their own general racism, several accounts tell of the cruelty from the mistress just as awful as from the men. One slave recalled the mistress beating her slaves with broomsticks or leather straps and giving such severe whippings for offenses so ridiculous as burning the toast. Another related being forced to walk on hot coals after being accused of carelessness. Several slaves reported that abusive mistresses administered daily whippings as mourning rituals. Former Texas slave Mary Armstrong recounted the height of such cruelties. When her 9-month-old sister persistently cried, as babies do, the mistress snapped and whipped the infant like any other slaves on the bare buttocks till the blood just ran, and it killed my sister. A case recorded as late as 1912 told how a white man in Georgia began kissing his black servant, who was married, in his kitchen, apparently trying to initiate sex. She resisted him and told her husband, who confronted the man. The white man slapped the black husband in the face and had him arrested. In court, the judge openly rejected the black woman's testimony by saying, This court will never take the word of a nigger against the word of a white man. And he fined her husband $25 for his impropriety. Melton A. McLaurin, in his book on a famous 1855 case of the slave girl Sella, provides perhaps the best summary of sexual abuse in the slave South. The sexual politics of slavery presented an exact paradigm of the power relationships within the larger society. Black female slaves were essentially powerless in a slave society, unable to legally protect themselves from the physical assault of either white or black males. White males, at the opposite extreme, were all powerful, with practically unlimited access to black females. The sexual politics of slavery in the antebellum South are perhaps the most clearly revealed by the fact that recorded cases of rape of female slaves are virtually non-existent. Black males were forbidden access to white females, and those charged with raping white females were either executed or, as in Missouri, castrated and sometimes lynched. Although on occasion a black male slave was charged with raping a female slave, such cases were extremely rare and convictions even rarer. Indeed, conviction was impossible since slave women were not protected from rape by law, no matter the color of her attacker. In Mississippi, for example, the state Supreme Court ruled in 1859 that the common law did not protect slaves, and that since no statute made slave rape a crime, a male slave so charged must be released. The case in question, George v. State of Mississippi, 1859, was far worse than generally reported. It involved the rape of a child under 10 years of age by an adult male slave. Even here, however, the power structures of the South could not and would not protect the girl. In light of the legal realities of the institution, the rapist defense attorney successfully argued, "The crime of rape does not exist between slaves. Their sexual intercourse is left to be regulated by their owners. The regulation of law as to the white race on the subject of sexual intercourse do not and cannot, for obvious reason, apply to slaves. Their intercourse is promiscuous, and the violation of a female slave by a male slave would be a mere assault and battery." Justice William Harris agreed that common law is not applicable to the status of the slave, and there is no act which embraces either the attempted or actual commission of rape by a slave on a female slave. The rapist walked. McLaurin's conclusion also provides a fitting end to this section. If the courts would not convict black males of raping slaves, then such a charge against a white male was ludicrous. Thus, in the antebellum South, the rape of slave women by white men, if not expected, was condoned by the law, or more precisely, by the lack of it. The meaning of liberty, freedom, and equality. One of the least discussed, yet very relevant, aspects of Southern culture has been its views of liberty. Several commentators then and now have discussed the hypocrisy of the American fight for liberty and independence. Our forefathers held slaves while demanding liberty and writing repeatedly that subjection to Britain would constitute nothing but abject slavery. But there is even a deeper rift over these terms than what is commonly discussed. Southern conservatives, including most of the church leaders, were not actually hypocrites in this sense, because they openly despised the language of the Declaration of Independence. To them, liberty did not mean freedom, and it certainly did not mean equality, not even in the most common understanding of that phrase, equality simply before the law. Dabney exemplified this view. In his defense, he confronted Jefferson's phrase that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For Dabney, if this can mean anything, it can only mean that each man is endowed only with a socially delimited liberty, and an equality only to some people, but not those above them. It can only mean the following. Each one, as truly entitled to possess the set of rights justly appropriate to him, and by the same reason as any other is entitled to his set of rights. This is man's moral equality. It means that under God, the servant is as much entitled to the rights and privileges of a justly treated servant as the master is to the rights of a master, that the commoner is as much entitled to the just privileges of a commoner as a peer to those of a peer. Likewise, liberty for Dabney only means privilege to do what each man in his particular circumstances has a moral right to do. And this carves out room not only to exalt an aristocratic class over others, but to hold slaves down in theirs. All this is perfectly consistent with the differences of social condition and station and privileges, where characters and relations are different. As we have seen, the servant for life, who is a slave, receives those things which are just and equal, has his true liberty, though it is different from that of a free citizen. As proof of these assertions, Dabney appealed to the framers of the era who maintained slaves themselves long after endorsing the document. He also, however, accepted the author of those immoral words, despite his contrary personal example, because he allegedly had contracted a fondness for the atheistical philosophy of the French political reformers. In other words, the words of the Declaration of Independence were a product of the French Revolution's atheism. Dabney was not alone in this view. Denunciations of Jefferson's phrase appear in various places in the Southern literature of the period. Prominent Southern minister Thomas Smith argued in 1866 that the principles of the Constitution were actually subverted by the infidel maxims of the Declaration of Independence. In his words, that convention ignored the infidel and atheistical maxims of the absolute freedom and equality of all men found in the Declaration of Independence, which were anarchical principles of wild and savage fanaticism. Presbyterian minister G.J.A. Colson was still preaching this doctrine vehemently in 1879. It is by no means a self-evident proposition that God made all men free and equal and endowed each individual with any certain inalienable rights. And this precise form of statement has grown axiomatic from long use and is invested with the power of a quotation from Holy Writ, while in fact it is a delusion invented by the devil. The revelation of God and the history of the world teach the same truth as opposed to this foolish postulate. God created some men for domination and massed multitudes more for subjection. In its historical context, this argument amounted to one thing, a defense of Southern slavery and segregation afterwards. It also was not hidden. Colson, for example, had employed this argument to support his claim that democratic theories that are erected upon the natural equality of men will not endure investigation. After all, the division of the race into ranks and classes is as real as the separation of the race into individual members. To understand this mental disconnect, we must understand that, as strange as it may sound to modern ears, there is a difference between liberty and freedom. While we use those words as synonyms today, their derivations are starkly different, and the differences relate to starkly different cultures. The term freedom comes from Germanic, Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Dutch culture, which conceived of freeborn rights. Everyone was born free and equal before the law. They may have differences in wealth or status, but none could be deprived of what was theirs by birthright. The rights of life and liberty and equal protection before the free institutions of law. This system lay behind English common law and was largely the system of law resurrected by Puritans and carried to New England, as well as that of Dutch and German settlers in America. Liberty, by contrast, has a Roman derivation, and its parent culture conceived of virtually the opposite reality. In classical culture, both Greek and Roman, the mass of humanity was born into bondage or some form of prior restraint. Roman libertas referred to the release of someone from their natural bondage. It was a right to independence and status that had to be achieved, and it was only achieved by the fittest elites of society. Liberty in this culture was thus class-oriented, and the leaders of the society could boast of it, while a majority of the society were nevertheless slaves. See if you can hear the echoes of Dabney's position in the description of ancient Rome by one prominent historian, writing in a completely different context, with no reference to Dabney or the South. In ancient Rome, liberty implied inequality. People were granted different liberties according to their condition. Some had many liberties, others had few or none. When you understand that the classical culture was imported to Britain with the Norman invasion in 1066 and survived in various forms until Anglican culture imported it further into the British colonies, notably those of the American South, Dabney's comments not only make sense, but the whole of Southern culture lights up in a new way. The emphasis on status, the divine right of the social order, the fierce and even violent defense of honor, as well as the insistence on a quasi-aristocracy, feudal manners and structures, and a slave society all make more than perfect sense. So does the relentless pursuit of classical studies among Southern intelligentsia, including the clergy. Appeals for the study of the classics appear in the Southern Presbyterian Review well into the Lost Cause era. In this light, Dabney's appeal to the Virginian framers was no bluff, nor would it have been at all surprising to his countrymen. John Randolph of Roanoke once openly stated, "I am an aristocrat. I love liberty. I hate equality." Historian Colin Woodward adds to this a catalog of ills Virginian culture contracted from this Roman worldview. Tidewater's leaders imposed libertas on their society in countless ways. They referred to themselves as heads of their respective manors, dictating duties to their hands and to other subservient appendages. Finding Jamestown and St. Mary's too crude, they built new government campuses in Williamsburg and Annapolis from central plans inspired by Rome. Williamsburg features a sumptuous formal palace for the governor, surrounded by a Versailles-like formal garden, and the elegant capitol, not state house, decorated with the relief of Jupiter, the god whose temple stood at the center of Roman civic life. They named counties, cities, and colonies after their superiors, English royals, Prince George, Prince William, Princess Anne, Jamestown, Williamsburg, Annapolis, Georgetown, Virginia, Maryland, or high nobles. Albemarle, Baltimore, Beaufort, Calvert, Cecil, Cumberland, Caroline, and Arundel, Delaware. While they were passionate in defending liberties, it would have never have occurred to them that those liberties might be shared with their subjects. Under this notion, Not only does the creation of a slaveocracy make sense, nor even just the willingness to create statutes defining the indefinite degradation of a whole section of the human race based upon the belief that group was naturally inferior, but also the dogged, desperate, and obliviously unrepentant fight to maintain the society that protected such a status. The only problem with this view is that a thing greater than libertas is here, and this thing called freedom is a jealous god. One of Martin Luther's great contributions to Western society was properly to infuse the idea of what has come to be called Christian liberty with the doctrine of what really is biblical Christian freedom. In reality, it is the ethic of love and the foundation for a society built upon love of neighbor. In the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther developed this idea in another way that showed the persistent power of an old folkway. He was troubled by the conflicts that his ideas had caused and argued that the freedom of a Christian should be understood as a love for others. Freiheit als Liebe, freedom as love, a bond between believers and the loving gift of God. This idea became a major theme in Luther's writing. It was taken up by Protestant reformers after him and has reverberated throughout the ages. Some of its strongest expressions appeared in English Puritan ideas of soul freedom, which meant the freedom that grew from unity with God and oneness with His Spirit. Soul freedom was thought to be a gift from God, which no mortal power could take away. In terms of law and society, this idea meant there existed a set of legal rights with which all men were born, which must be allowed to everyone, and which every person was bound to respect in others. The rights spoken of in the Declaration of Independence may have filtered through Locke to Jefferson, but they had been preached in New England pulpits for over a century prior. They represented the freedom and rights spoken of in biblical law and much, not all, Puritan theology. When Dabney and the other Southern theologians read the Declaration, they could not comprehend a society in which such rights existed for everyone. They were reading through the lens of their worldview of Roman libertas. In their world, blacks had not yet achieved the right to liberty, and if it was given to them, they would not be able to handle it. Blinded by classical studies and classical literature, these theologians had not yet understood the depths of the Bible, biblical law, or freedom. To them, these things were as alien as the atheism of the French Revolution. Not complicit in man-stealing? Another frequently repeated criticism of American slavery was one of those highlighted from Quaker George Keith, the kidnapping at the root of it. Biblical law condemned this in the strongest terms in the older translations as man-stealing and assigned for it the death penalty, Exodus 21:16. Dabney openly acknowledged this, as most defenders of slavery did, yet he also vigorously defended the institution anyway. He responded, "We fully admit, then, that the title of the original slave catcher to the captured African was most unrighteous. But few can be ignorant of the principle that the title, originally bad, may be replaced by a good one, by transmission from hand to hand and by lapse of time. When the property has been acquired by the latest holder, fairly and honestly, when in the later transfers a fair equivalent was paid for it, and the last possessor is innocent of fraud in intention and in the actual mode of his acquisition of it, common sense says, and whatever may have been the original title, a new and valid one has arisen out of the circumstances of that case." Dabney goes on to repeat a common argument based on this foundation. If this principle be denied, half the property of the civilized world will be divorced from its present owners, because land in America, Europe, Britain, and many other places has long since been obtained by fraud or violence against natives or other nations. Shall all Americans give up their property and homes to Indians in light of this? The issue of the incipient man-stealing, of course, brings up the distinction between the slave trade and the institution. Although both were intimately linked and both equally reprehensible in Western culture, it is sometimes rebutted that since Muslims had driven slaves for a century already in Africa, we should not hold Europeans or Americans responsible for starting it, and if we blame whites, we ought just as strongly to blame the African chieftains. While Islam was responsible, however, it was largely in the eastern and northern parts of the continent, whereas the vast majority of slaves for the Americas came from Western and Central Africa. Likewise, although chieftains bear responsibility, they played only a facilitative role once the Portuguese started the trade. The Western demand for slaves soon stimulated raids in areas with little or no Islamic influence, and it grew and thrived with little or no help from Islam. This new demand was a new force which affected areas of Africa in new ways. Prior to Western involvement, slavery within these parts of Africa was largely a parochial form of social dependency. Slaves may have been taken in tribal warfare, or may have been subjugated for economic reasons. With increased demand from foreign traders, however, slaves immediately became a valuable commodity. Warlords, sometimes armed with weapons they obtained in the trade, led raids for the express purpose of enslaving individuals for sale to Europeans. The vast majority of victims were enslaved through slave raids, kidnapping, or legal manipulations. Some substantial cases used religious deception and trickery with local oracles, but the end result was kidnapping nonetheless. The Atlantic slave trade, in effect, led to the creation of a vast political and social institution in Africa that was devoted to producing slaves for Western consumption, which decimated entire populations and which had not existed as such before. It was no subtle shift, but rather a radical break in the history of Africa. Slave exports rose drastically in the 1600s, then exploded in the 1700s, totaling about 6.5 million souls in that century alone. By the time the Atlantic slave trade was finally ended, it had exported 12.8 million victims. Another 12 million newly enslaved victims never left Africa. They either died during the enslavement process or were simply never sold. These atrocities, after 1700, were, for the most part, not the natural result of native slave wars, but of the phenomenon that would have not taken place without the demand from the West. It is hard to deny that Westerners bear strong culpability, therefore, even for the very creation of the slave trade and the initial enslavements of most of the African slaves. Had there not been demand for such millions, along with Western complicity in arms, resources, finances, and more, the chieftains would hardly have engaged in most of the wars and raids which produced the supply. This complicity was knowledgeable, willing, purposeful, and sustained for well over three centuries by all the major sea powers of the Western world. The American slave traders and buyers knew exactly what was going on, and they approved of it, kidnapping and all. Even had this not been the case, even if the slaves had simply fallen innocently into American slaveholders' accounts, Dabney's analogy to land titles reveals the deep flaw in what was an oft-repeated defense of slaveholding in light of its indefensible origins. With land disputes, we are discussing that which is already indisputably property and can be nothing else. With the slaves, the discussion is nothing of the sort. Instead, the discussion is of that which should never have been property to begin with. Justice, in this case, is not a discussion of property, but life and liberty. It is not a discussion of property disputes. It is a discussion of man-stealing. Justice is not restored by monetary values or stumps. It requires, according to God's law, the death penalty and the release of the wrongfully enslaved person. John H. Thornwell seemed more sensitive than Dabney to this question, so he took a little different angle. How could anyone justify a system that only perpetuated a grievous injustice? Thornwell retreated into the mystery of God's providential ordering of affairs. The answer turns upon the distinction between the wrong itself and the effects of the wrong. The criminal act, whatever it may have been, by which a man was reduced to the condition of bondage, can never cease to be otherwise than criminal. But the relations to which that act gave rise may themselves be consistent with the will of God and the foundation of new and important duties. The relations of man to his natural offspring, though wickedly formed, give rise to duties which would be ill discharged by the destruction of the child. No doubt the principle upon which slavery has been most largely engrafted into society as an integral element of its complex constitution, the principle that captivity in war gives a right to the life of a prisoner for which his bondage is accepted in exchange, is not consistent with the truth of the case, but it is recognized as true for ages and generations. It was a step in the moral development of nations and has laid the foundations of institutions and usages, which cannot now be disturbed with impunity and in regard to which our conduct must be regulated by the fact of their existence and not by speculation upon the morality of their origin. By this argument, Thornwell succeeds in doing nothing but confessing that the slave system was founded in wickedness. Beyond that, his only objection to doing anything about it was that it had been tolerated for so long it had become an institution. In other words, it had been tolerated so long that it should be tolerated still, or that it had become so tolerated that most people, not enslaved by it, would be opposed to not tolerating it. The argument turns providence into fatalism. Each step in the moral development of nations takes place under the hand of God, but each step within the control of Christian individuals and Christian societies occurs with God's express commands to us how to act in relation to each other. When we come across a falsely imprisoned or wrongfully enslaved person, we set them free if we can. If we cannot, we fight for justice in their case. Even if all we can do is preach justice, we should do it. Dabney and Thornwell each had one of the most prominent voices and pulpits in the South, yet they neglected to preach justice and instead appealed to God's inscrutable handling of history as a reason to perpetuate the injustice. Unlike questions of simple property, justice for man-stealing and holding the stolen person in slavery has no statute of limitations. The only form of slavery left today by which we could relate is the prison system. If an innocent man were wrongly imprisoned, would we deny him freedom on the argument that he had already been moved from prison to prison enough times to turn a bad court conviction to a good one? Would we deny him freedom on the argument that he had already been in so long? What if the prison company, crew, guards, etc., all had a deep financial stake in keeping him in prison, and it was profitable? Would you deny his freedom? Even if we granted a form of slave society in which people could be acknowledged as property before the law, would a kidnapped man's case receive justice by appeal to the wrongful property claim layered on top of the crime of man-stealing? Can any changing of hands after those subsequent titles make them good? Absolutely not. That is the end of Dabney's rebuttal. The South stands guilty of accomplice to man-stealing and aggravated man-stealing of millions of souls. It defied God's law and engaged in the sins of Babylon. The root fear. The common defense against man-stealing had the added feature, particularly useful after the transatlantic slave trade had been abolished, of joining in the condemnation of the original kidnapping and the trade while still exonerating one's systematic enjoyment of the fruits of it. It created a way to assume slaves were property without due process and dismiss the question of whether they ever should have been so to begin with. To answer this latter question in the negative, however, would have left the logical deduction that the only proper justice for the slaves would have been immediate and full emancipation. The South's violent reaction to the thought permeated not only all of colonial, revolutionary, and antebellum history, but also came to the fore as soon as emancipation had become a reality. This is where the root prejudices would be driven to the surface. Why not emancipate them? The financial motive is obvious, but there is another just as intense, especially for the religious ideologues. It was one Dabney would repeat when he opposed equality of blacks in the church, as well as black suffrage years later. He unleashed the same rhetoric here at the end of his defense. He feared that the forces which brought abolition, having enforced a violent emancipation, they would enforce, of course, Negro suffrage, Negro eligibility to office, a full Negro equality. That Negro equality thus theoretically established would be a practical Negro superiority that the tyrant section, as it gave to its victims, the white men of the South, more and more causes of just resentment, would find more and more violent inducements to bribe the Negroes with additional privileges and gifts to assist them in their domination, that this miserable career must result in one of two things: either a war of the races, in which the whites or the blacks would be, one or the other, exterminated, or amalgamation. While we believe that God made of one blood all nations of men to dwell under the whole heavens, we know that the African has become, according to a well-known law of natural history, by the manifold influences of the ages, a different, fixed species of the race, separated from the white man by traits bodily, mental, and moral, almost as rigid and permanent as those of genus. Hence, the offspring of an amalgamation must be a hybrid race, stamped with all the feebleness of the hybrid, and incapable of the career of civilization and glory as an independent race. And this apparently is the destiny which our conquerors have in view. If indeed they can mix the blood of the heroes of Manassas with this vile stream from the fens of Africa, then they will never again have occasion to tremble before the righteous resistance of Virginian freedmen, but will have a race supple and vile enough to fill that position of political subjection which they desire to fix the South. A prophetic voice. With these aspects of Dabney's defense now in hindsight, and there are many more of like character, there is yet one corrective voice we should consider in contradistinction to them. A young minister, well acquainted with Dabney, the issue and the opponents of which he wrote, nevertheless held a somewhat less defensive and somewhat more self-critical view of the institution. In its willingness to hold the South accountable for her sins, including the sins built into and protected by the legal structure of the institution of slavery, as well as its prescience into inevitable judgment, this young minister's voice could almost be called prophetic. In a letter in 1840, he wrote, "I do not believe that we ought to rest contented that slavery should exist forever in its present form. It is, as a system, liable to most erroneous abuses. Do you think that there will be a system of slavery where the black is punished with death for an offense for which a white man is only imprisoned for a year or two, where the black may not resist wanton aggression and injury, where he is liable to have his domestic relations violated in an instant, where the female is not mistress of her own chastity, where the slave is liable to starvation, oppression, and cruel punishment from an unprincipled master, that such a system can exist in the millennium? If not, then, is it an obstacle to the Prince of Peace? And if we should see his chariot roll on among the prostrate nations, it is our duty to remove this obstruction. Again, he warned another reader in 1851. But to enjoy the advantages of this Bible argument in our favor, slaveholders will have to pay a price. And the price is this. They must be willing to recognize and grant in slaves those rights which are a part of our essential humanity, some of which are left without recognition or guarantee by law, and some infringed by law, that these are the rights of immortal and domestic beings. If we take the ground that the power to neglect and infringe these interests is essential and necessary part of the institution of slavery, then it cannot be defended. One thing is certain, the relations of a mortal being to his maker override all others. We must come out and grant that our right to hold slaves to labor does not include a right to make a husband guilty of the sin of separation from his wife for other cause than fornication, or to violate the chastity of a female by forcible means, and that practices or laws which do any of these things are not a part of the scriptural and lawful institution, but abuses. Unless Southern men are willing to take this position, they cannot conquer in the discussion. These elucidations denounce the legal and social system which violated slave marriages and families, which left slaves vulnerable to physical abuse, left slave women exposed to sexual exploitation, which maintained unequal laws and unequal applications of law to blacks and whites, etc. These letters denounce as unscriptural and abuses not only such acts, but the laws that protected them, and the author admitted that such practices could not remain before the rule of Christ, would lead only to defeat by abolitionists, were an obstacle to justice and peace, and were the South's duty to remove. These points were the exact antithesis of those in this chapter outlined and defended by Dabney, and the young minister who penned them was Robert L. Dabney. While we could concede that Dabney's views changed over time, there is no mistaking that these two letters reveal that he knew better about several damning practices he later either denied or minimized. His own words from 1840 and 1851 stand as proof that he was well aware that female slaves were sexually exposed, slaves in general were vulnerable to attacks, and families were ripped apart, and he condemned the laws that allowed these things as unscriptural and abuses. He knew the abuses existed, and he knew the system was indefensible because of them. He knew the system should and would come under judgment for these things. But in 1867, in dreadful fear of social amalgamation with blacks, Dabney spoke differently. He entrenched himself in utter defense of the system. He defended the indefensible. Worse, he defended what he knew for a fact was indefensible. That is not just being a Southern rebel. It is being a rebel against God and conscience. Dabney knew the South could not prevail in her contest on those terms. And he was right.
The Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network brings to you a complete lineup of podcasts where you will hear practical and tactical theology. Our desire is not simply that you consume our shows, but that you also live out your faith in every area of life. We can talk all day long about these things, but if we fail to put them into practice, then we fail as ambassadors of Jesus Christ, our King. Subscribe now to your favorite Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network shows, Or you can subscribe to the Reconstructionist Radio Master Feed, where all of the content we produce, including the audiobooks and audio articles, will pop up as soon as they are available. And don't forget to visit ReconstructionistRadio.com to volunteer as a narrator or to partner with this ministry financially. May the Holy Spirit stir you into action for Christ and His kingdom.